Guitars.
Yes, no. She has songs that my kids hardly there, and then my kids are totally
so. We know where we are. We're in the process of setting up on our
so it might be
on our webpage.
On our Facebook page.
It might go global.
Go viral.
Whatever the word is.
Oh, that's the gizmo right there.
That's the gizmo, yeah.
You know, at
Shambhala Center in Boulder, they have drawer after drawer after drawer of tapes. And I don't think anyone listens to them anymore.
No, right? You need to convert them all to MP3 and put them online. A lot of work.
I don't think that would make any difference. So, do we begin with a bow here?
Yeah.
We may certainly do that. So, if you're not used to this, the basic idea is respect and sort of opening the door to communication with everyone here. So, together.
You're not bowing to the tape recorder.
The tape recorder may be participating. I actually know.
It's listening.
Okay. I think the next thing we should do is introduce each other. My name is Walter Taylor, and I live in Boulder, and I've lived there a long time, and I've been studying meditation through Shambhala, or whatever it used to be called, for about 30 years. And I would like to know everybody else's name. Like Margot, what's your name?
My name is Margot Hedrick, and I've been attending here at Longmont Shambhala for about a year and a half. Really appreciate both the lineage and this sweet sangha.
I'm Doris Peppercorn. I think I've been studying Shambhala about 7 years. I do live in Longmont, so it's quite convenient to be here.
You, sir.
I'm Bill Lifford. I'm the coordinator for this group. I live in Longmont 12 years now. I started in Shambhala 26 years ago.
I'm Deborah Crabb. I'm here in Longmont, and this is my second meeting. So I'm new.
New? Did you do meditation with any other group?
Yes, for many years.
Oh, okay. What do you find different here?
Actually, not much. Oh. That's why it kind of resonates with me, because I really, I think the whole way everything's done, sort of, it resonates in me.
Your name is Deborah.
Deborah.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Katie, and this is my first night here. I don't think I've ever gone to a Shambhala practice before, but I have been doing meditation since my early 20s, and this is a new kind, but I did Vipassana for many years, so this is a little different, a little more formal in some ways, but there is a basically very similar. Mm-hmm. I feel comfortable with them. I don't think there's a Vipassana group in Longmont. Mm-hmm. I think there's one in Boulder. Mm-hmm. But this feels very sympathetic.
Okay.
And I came because I've been meaning to come for years. I've gone and been to the Thich Nhat Hanh a few times. And Deborah just moved here, and she said, I went. And I was like, oh, I guess I better come with you, because I've been putting it off for years.
Okay. So you all know each other from...
We've known each other for a long time.
Yeah. Okay. My name's Tim. I live at Mama. I'm married to Doris. I'm kind of an occasional Shambhala meditating kind of person. Usually she's a motivator. I've taken a couple classes over at Boulder a few years ago. I like it.
Oh, good. Well, thank you for being here.
Yeah.
I'm Trudy Lightrick. I'm married to that fellow over there. And he always says his role, and I never say my role. also I will say that I actually chairperson for the health and well-being group that which we have, which actually has a support group that's facilitated by a psychologist. We try to extend ourselves to our community when they have need, and we sort of take care of the extras, like the wild animal sanctuary trip and various hikes and things like that. So that's sort of my role. And I never can do the math that quickly, so I think I would say I started sitting in 1984, started the Shambhala path. I guess it's a lot of them.
I'm Rebecca, and I think I did level one with you.
Did you?
About 10 years ago, up at the Shambhala Mountain Center. So it's kind of cool that you're here now. You haven't really been following the Shambhala path all these years. But
did you ever do level two after that?
No.
I'm the good influence I am.
I really didn't even, when I signed up, I really didn't even know it was going to be a full weekend of meditation.
Surprise.
I was pretty freaked out for a while. But I did finish. Yeah. I didn't skip anything. But anyway, so, yeah.
Okay.
So, thanks for that.
You're back.
That's great.
Do you live around here?
I do. I live in Longmont now.
Uh-huh,
yes. I'm a Longmontian officially.
And he's is that what one says, Longmontian?
It's a Longmonter.
Longmonter.
Oh, Longmonter.
Yeah.
Okay. I've been wondering that for years, actually.
Now you've reached out to Longmont. Here you are. Okay.
You're a Boulderite, a Longmonter.
Denverite?
Denverite, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm here to lead a discussion, and the topic tonight is going to be generosity, about which, you know, Oodles' whole library could be filled with what the Buddhist path has had to say about generosity. But I have a few just little things that we could discuss. And I want to begin, actually, by advertising a new book that's just come out that you might not have seen. Has everyone seen this book? This is volume two of a three-volume set called The Profound Treasury of the Ocean of Dharma. It's teachings of Chögyam Trungpa, which he gave during three-month programs that he called seminaries. People would decamp to a hotel in Pennsylvania or something like that and stay there 3 months, and those teachings happened year after year, and the original teachings have become hard to get out of print and whatnot. And someone named Judith L. Leaf, who happens to be the wife of the president of Naropa now, she underwent this enormous, undertook this enormous project of compiling all that and sort of pulling together the parts where he repeated himself in 1982 from 1981 and that sort of thing, and made this giant three-volume book. I'm going to pass it around so you can see it. You might want to acquire this. It's also in paperback. It is really a complete compendium of almost, anyway, of what Chögyam Trungpa. People, anyone in doubt about who Chögyam Trungpa is? You know who he is? Yeah, okay. So he was the founder of the meditation group we're in back in the early 70s, and I'm not going to repeat his story right now. But in any case, I found some things in that book that have to do with generosity, and I'm going to start to share them in just a moment here. Well, maybe one more level of background that I should mention here is we have the Buddhist path divided, as we see it anyway, divided between Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. Are those terms familiar to everyone, or is that new material familiar to you? Hinayana meaning, and roughly speaking, meaning working on one's own project of liberation. Mahayana referring to how that project relates to others and how we're not just doing this for ourselves, but there's a whole world that's involved. And so the words compassion and generosity tend to show up. And this book that I'm passing around right now is the Mahayana volume, volume 2 out of 3.
So the 3 volumes that in Hinayana,
Mahayana,
and Vajrayana?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's because these are really based on those seminaries, and those seminaries were divided into a Hinayana period, a Mahayana period, about a month each, and a Vajrayana period. And Vajrayana finally having to do with the magical element or the devotional element of you and your guru. A couple of questions about generosity. How can we cultivate generosity? How can we not feel bad or embarrassed about generosity? And how can we let generosity be part of our path? Anybody want to say anything on any of those questions? Has anyone here ever been embarrassed by generosity or the lack of generosity? Or what do I do?
Never. Actually, today I just spoke with someone, and this is a little bit by way of an update about Carolyn. Scrawn is one of our regulars, and who is in Connecticut with her mom who's dying. And could use some help. And Carolyn is a very liberated and independent woman who has a great deal of difficulty receiving generosity from others. She's been, you know, working and looking to do, raise her kids on her own. So I think there are lots of people like that out there.
And it's often us. Maybe. Have this problem of being a little embarrassed by the whole thing. So, to kind of start this off with something to do, I want the sort of ground floor of this talk to be a certain saying that some may have heard before and some may have not, and that is, generosity is the virtue that produces peace. Have you heard this before? Is there anything like it?
Yes.
And you've certainly heard it before. Generosity is the virtue that produces peace. Yeah. Is it completely obvious what that means?
I interpret it as generosity is an action of receiving another person's truth. So you're hearing that person.
And where's the peace come in?
When you are heard and received, then you can find peace.
Okay, yeah. Any other take on that? That's certainly not the one possibility, but not. There's lots of ways you could go with this.
Mm-hmm. Would you read it again?
Yeah, generosity is the virtue that produces peace.
That produces.
And possibly it'll help if I say that this was typically said during one of these seminaries that I just mentioned when meals were being served.
Ah.
As a kind of group chant. There was more to the chant, but so it maybe had a little something to do with food.
Well, I know that if I have more than someone else and I know they're in need, it'll nag at me. So I it makes sense that being generous would lead to peace, because then you don't have that little voice anymore telling us to do it, you know. But I'm thinking in terms of monetary and physical, and I think that what you're talking about goes beyond that, to a whole mindset of generosity.
That's a really good insight.
So, yeah, I think that we've all been there at one time or another when just some kind of generous action, doesn't have to be money by any means, has brought us to a point of sort of feeling better, or maybe it shows us what it's really like to be a human in the best sense of the word. Peace coming to us. In my neighborhood, there's a place where we often walk, and we go down an alley, my significant other and me, and one of these houses on this alley has chickens in the backyard, just behind a fence, and she's put a little, or somebody has put a little basket full of chicken feed and a scoop, and it says, "Feed the chicken. Feed the chickens. One scoop only, please." And so every time we go by there, we take the chicken feed and throw a little on the ground, and the chickens. And somehow it makes us feel better, you know. Yeah. I don't know quite what it is, but and it's not exactly generosity on our part. It's somebody else already provided all that stuff, but it's somehow very, very satisfying to be able to meet somebody else's needs, even if small and momentary.
It feels even to be invited into that experience.
Yeah, somebody has invited us into that experience, so that was also very generous. And then we're allowed to express our generosity, and I mean, such as it is in that case.
I think the chickens, I take garden scraps to my neighbor's chickens, and they are so happy to receive it.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's part of that energetic exchange that happens when someone's open. I mean, the chickens are really open. They make you so happy, and their gift back is you just see all this happiness.
They're not embarrassed.
They come out, they're not embarrassed at all. They make noises and they scratch around, and you just stand there feeling happy watching them do it.
Yeah, that's my point exactly. Yeah. So.
And what occurs to me as I sit with all of this is that feeling of, you could say that illusion of the separate self is dispelled. Mm-hmm. And the connective tissue is exposed.
Oh, there goes half my talk. You got to
turn around three times.
There's a lot more in here, there's
lots of other stuff in
here. All under generosity.
Did you just look it up?
Yeah.
No, I just opened the book and there's generosity and then three gifts.
Three gifts, yeah.
And I happen to scan them, so we can talk about some more.
Yeah, okay. Actually, the next thing I wanted to talk about was, if we talk about virtue producing peace, we might wonder, why are we so concerned with peace? And about the only answer seems to be that a lot of the time, we're not feeling peace. Otherwise, this slogan wouldn't be of much interest. And why are we not feeling peace?
I think actually sometimes even when you're generous you don't feel that peace because you have some attachment to the act of being generous.
So. Okay, so what was the A word?
Attachment.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some kind of, and it's certainly true that our generosity can be marked with all kinds of pride or whatnot. But, yeah, so this very slogan just makes us look at the first noble truth and the second noble truth. And what do those say? I think you've already said it, but do you want to say?
No. I'm blank. I can't remember any noble truths.
Suffering.
So the first noble truth in very condensed format is that there is suffering, or that life is marked with suffering. Our human struggle on this planet is marked with suffering. And the second noble truth went on to explain that in terms of, as you say, attachment. So we have, so this nice little slogan just actually points right at the most basic of Buddhist teachings. And then third noble truth is that there is some way out of this, that we can begin to experience some moments of non-attachment and less suffering. And the fourth noble truth is an outline of things to do, the so-called Eightfold Path, and I'm not going to talk about that tonight. But even the third noble truth of just the fact that we can experience some stepping back from our suffering and from our attachment is very well illustrated in this slogan about virtue that produces peace. And as you say, it's really getting away from our separateness, but coming back to full. Now, sometimes we make a mantra out of things. Mantra meaning a word or phrase being repeated to some beneficial effect. And sometimes the effect is just to remember it. So I think I've seen this one, sometimes called contemplations too, on sakyong.com. Mm-hmm. That's the Sakyong, being Sakyong Mipam. Do you know who Sakyong Mipam is? The son of Chögyam Trungpa, who's now... He writes a lot of books, all of them. I could spend the whole time just talking about his books, but I won't. And he's got a website called sakyong.com, and he's got a new contemplation or mantra every day that you can try. And I think this one has been on there or something like it. So we could actually just repeat this phrase a few times and let it sink in. Would you like to try that? You can try that for a minute and a half or so out loud, and then we'll continue at our own pace silently for another minute and a half. Okay, so meditation is the virtue that produces peace. Generosity is the virtue that produces peace. Divinity is the virtue that produces peace. How'd you like that? You see the merit of trying something like that? The Dalai Lama has another favorite contemplation, which is simply, may all beings be happy, done about the same way. I wanted to mention that there is a sort of opposite of peace, and coming from generosity, and that is regret coming from failure of generosity. Mm-hmm. I've never experienced this, of course. But though I have to say that I can't quantify this or prove it, but probably the regret, the most stinging regret we experience, or I experience, is coming out of failure of generosity, when you realize, oh, we blew that opportunity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I had one not that long ago, and it was during the middle of the winter, this past winter, and I was at Safeway, and a very pregnant, I mean very pregnant, woman in front of me in line with two little kids, full basket. She goes through the line, checks everything, writes her check, and it was, what do you call it, was not approved.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a lot of extra money at the time, but I could have paid for her groceries, because she calls, I think, in the husband.
Yeah.
This is what just, you know, she's pretty frantic, and now she's in tears, and now she has to just leave. She just leaves the grocery, you know, with the kids, going to the car, and I've always regretted that I didn't do that, because I could have. It's one of those moments, you know.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that with me and the others. It makes me sad.
Yeah.
It probably makes everyone sad.
It kind of makes me sad, but I like the story, because I think the next time we're in those situations, we'll be a little bit more proactive, you know. So those things help me to remind me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What it raised for me was the idea of what if you didn't have the money to cover the groceries, what else could you offer in some way?
Mm-hmm.
That was just a question. How could we have extended in some way? Comfort or support to the woman.
Sakyong Mipham says that regret is an important part of our Dharma education. And so I particularly recommend one of Sakyong Mipham's book is entitled Ruling Your World. Have you seen this book? Maybe right over there in the library. I don't know. And he's one of the early chapters in that book is entitled The Utility of Regret. And he's saying what I guess we all sort of know, but it's good to hear him say it, that wallowing in regret is of no use. And making a big emotional deal out of it may not be of any use, but actually paying attention and learning from the situation is absolutely essential. Only he says it better than I did. I want to talk next about, or have us talk next about, the path of generosity. That was the kind of ground floor of generosity that we just talked about, but there's actually a path to generosity laid out, well, it's described in here and in many other Buddhist sources, and that's called the Bodhisattva path. Bodhisattva meaning someone who's undertaken the idea of actually working for the benefit of others and also indirectly for one's own benefit, kind of true liberation, as we've pointed out already. The true liberation comes from breaking attachments, from breaking down barriers between others, as you said. Mm-hmm. And someone who's engaged in that path can be called a bodhisattva. And there are 6 transcendental actions of the bodhisattva, also known by the Sanskrit word paramita. And we're not really going to go into all of them. The first one is generosity. So the first paramita, the sort of opening way to work with yourself, particularly if you want this path, this so-called Mahayana path, is the idea of generosity. And generosity paramita is, in fact, all the paramitas, they're not like earning an MD, where, you know, all of a sudden, okay, you graduate from medical school, you got your MD, they're going to call you MD the rest of your life, and you're just fine, there's no way they can, this can be quarreled with. Whereas the bodhisattva designation really is always referring to a path. And it's really considered our natural state. So it's not like we're trying to find something that we weren't before. Going back to the Buddha and his noble truths, he's talking about obscuration rather than innate problem when he talks about attachment. Mm-hmm. The attachment is something that clouds our mind, whereas our background mind, our full, open, and usable mind is unborn, free, completely open to buying groceries or anything else. So let's see what else I have about that. And there's a whole chapter in this book about how to follow the path of generosity in that situation. And it's very interesting. Trungpa says, begin simply. He says, don't try for anything too complex. Begin simply with a smile, or just some beauty, injecting some beauty into life, or some loving kindness. And then here's something that Trudy was mentioning a minute ago. There are considered to be 3 levels of generosity when you're working on the generosity paramita. The first is material generosity, which could mean groceries or anything else, really, or smile, cooking somebody a meal, just saying hello. Second step, the second level of generosity, has to do with fearlessness, as you were saying, the gift of fearlessness. How could we possibly give fearlessness to somebody? Or has somebody ever done this for us? Anyone want to say anything about that?
I think listening without judgment is a way that people...
I didn't hear the story.
Listening without judgment.
Yeah, listening without judgment.
Without judgment is something that allows them to be less fearful of being judged.
What else?
I experienced that in my birthings, my children and people who were there with me.
There's a lot of fear surrounding that.
Well, just the whole process. I mean, birthing a person is pretty risky business.
Yeah.
You can speak. You don't know what's happening sometimes.
Well, yeah, and more generally, there's a lot of fear surrounding all kinds of medical situations. You know. Mm-hmm. Often, if one seeks advice or help, sometimes it's just kind of the fear situation. And I was thinking of your person in the grocery store. I mean, it was partly groceries, but it was partly fear, right? To have to go home without...
And embarrassed.
Yeah. Not having the money to support, the funds to support it.
Yeah. I think there's a fearlessness, a gift of fearlessness to step into that place in one-on-one relationship where it's sometimes hard to say what you feel you need to say. But that's a gift to the relationship, in a sense, by being willing to be the one in that any given moment who's willing to go there.
Yeah, and that can be tough too. And along with this path quality is something called the slogans of a teacher. I spoke here in this group. I led a group about a year ago on the slogans of a teacher, but I don't know anybody. Maybe it's a just different group. Have people encountered these at all? There's a long list of slogans, but I'm just going to tell you one or two of them. And the idea is it's kind of like contemplations that we already did. It's something that can rest in your memory and hopefully come up when needed. That may be the hard part. And his first slogan we're not going to talk about is his first train in the preliminaries, which means do your meditation. And so that's kind of given for us tonight. The second slogan of Atisha is regard all dharmas as streams. Here, dharma meaning anything we encounter, anything that seems factual and comes to us is a dream. And Trungpa says that the first two slogans relate to generosity. Now, what does it mean to regard everything as a dream, and how does that relate to generosity?
You ask a hard question.
Yeah, you got to do some work here. I'm giving you the gift of hard work.
Mm-hmm. That's the kind of statement I never quite believe.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, everything's a dream. It's just, I can't wrap my mind around that. Or I can't make myself believe that.
Well, how about something's a dream? Would you believe that?
Not really. Not unless I was really dreaming.
Or would you believe that everything is temporary?
Yeah. That's okay.
And illusory in a certain kind of way?
Yeah.
And or subjective?
Well, yeah, those are okay. So I guess
why does it use the word dream?
Why does he use the word dream? You know, it's said that, you know, to really wake up from our struggle is kind of like waking up from a dream that you see See, all the struggles really don't have any content. It's kind of going after ephemeral things that you can't really put your finger on. Even though, at the same time, everything's terribly important. I mean, you know, whether you'll have a meal tonight is pretty important. But somehow, there's a struggle there too. So, the Buddhist ideal seems to be to, at the same time as seeing, you know, that it's very important that somebody should be well fed, at the same time, not believing in any of it, seeing the kind of emptiness of it. So we're kind of here looking at the corner of the idea of emptiness.
Beyond us.
Okay.
And how does this tie in with generosity?
How does this tie in with generosity? Well, I think it's already been said here that your struggle, your part of what's keeping us from being generous is our belief completely centered upon the importance of our little project. The importance of my little project means I couldn't possibly stop the car and give a dollar to some guy on the sidewalk. Or I couldn't possibly stop on the highway because I'm due in Denver at 7:35 and it's already 7:10. I mean, you know, we can all invent hundreds of these things. Or we could tell stories of avoiding generosity just because our project is so important. Is that making sense? Sakyong Wipam calls it not our project, but what does he call it? The me plan. That we're all completely involved in the me plan. Maybe I should have brought there's a song video done by the Sakyong, and it's called "What About Me."
We have that. We should bring it some night and play it.
We should definitely have a play of it. So that's showing you that. Well, he ultimately says, "What about you?"
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "I feel better already," or something like that.
So it's a matter of unhitching from self-centeredness.
Yeah.
Expanding out into, incorporating other people into your consciousness.
Yeah, and self-centeredness is a kind of dream. Self is really going to evaporate, and it's not very important. It's from some.
I feel deflated every time you say that.
Well, yeah. We want to be important. Yeah. Everything is our great struggle to be important, well taken care of.
I remember when I first heard that regard all dharmas as dreams.
Did you go up and smoke or what?
Pardon?
You stayed on earth though.
Oh yeah, I did. But then I started thinking about the life, you know. I mean, I've lived long enough now, and the things that happened a long time ago. It's not clear when a long time ago begins.
Yeah.
But they're really not much different than dreams. There are some experience I went through, and you know, sometimes there were other people involved, and that seems more real until those people die, and then it's just me. And then, what's the difference between something that happened not right now and a dream I had last night? It's sort of. It's hard to distinguish, you know? And I think Trudy's mom's been living with us now for a while, and she remembers things that never happened. You know, well, maybe I'm doing the same thing.
Yeah, just at dinner tonight, I said to Chris, "What'd you say about a telephone call?" And she said, "I didn't say anything about a telephone call." So, was it a dream?
You're hearing things again.
But, I mean, somehow it seems as though if you can realize that things that have happened aren't really so much different from a dream, maybe things that are happening really aren't so much different either.
Does it in any way point to the importance of just being present? Not
I think so. Because we get so caught up in the dream that we surround things with. And now, you know, the teachings in this book also talk about relative and absolute truth, and there is a relative truth. There's truth that this is a meditation mat and this is a book, and you can't change those truths, but they're kind of dreamlike compared with the ultimate truths having to do with the need for lack of struggle and the importance of compassion in life. I want to leave you with, I'm going to stop by 9 o'clock because that's what we do here. I'm going to just stop with one more idea that has been linked with generosity, and that's what's called threefold purity. It is said that the actions of a bodhisattva have threefold purity, and the threefold purity is this: there's no actor, there's no object of action, and there's in fact no action. So in the world of giving and generosity, this translates to there's no giver, no receiver, no gift. What could that possibly mean?
That could cause some dreams.
It's what?
That could cause some dreams.
Some dreams, yeah. There's no giver. In other words, if I give you something, I shouldn't blow myself up on it. I don't want to promote myself to the role of giver, somebody and get a halo. But it's just a natural action because of some kind of need. And that also applies if you didn't give and you've got some regret and some remorse even about that, it's still, there's no person who didn't give. There's no recipient. No one, you know, when true wholehearted giving happens, there's nobody has to say, oh, I'm so happy that they gave to me, or I'm so embarrassed that I didn't have it myself and they had to give me. So you made me feel bad, made me feel good, but all of that is really not there in a completely wholehearted situation. And no gift means that sort of, you know, it was nothing. It's just what happened. So I think I find that personally very helpful in terms of embarrassment about maybe somebody's giving me too much, or maybe I want to give but I don't want to admit it, or the worst thing of all is being of two minds about giving. And this happens to me if I see somebody, homeless person, wanting money from a car. I'm always of two minds about that. Well, of course I should give something to this person, but no, I really, there's no good reason to, you know, you can probably experience some of these things, but if there's really no ultimate reality to being giver or receiver, maybe we could just relax with it and not be embarrassed or clouded over. Well, that's all I'm going to say, but would anybody like to say anything more? How do you feel about generosity after these little ideas? Deborah, you're smiling, is there?
No, I just was thinking, thank you for generously giving us of your time.
No,
I feel very peaceful.
It's making me think of the Eastern and Middle Eastern cultures have, it's very deeply in their culture to those pathways of generosity that, you know, it's very natural. And I think in our culture, we're more, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. We have more of a puritanical influence. So some of these things are harder. But I just think of when I traveled in the East, how people were just incredibly present to travelers. I mean, to strange, or to, I'm not putting it very well, but that barrier between the person who's, you know, looking for something or needs something or invite you in and give you a cup of tea when they have nothing. But it's not like they're puffed up at all. It's like deeply ingrained.
Well, this is some threefold purity is what you're talking about. It sounds like.
And it's so much part of their culture that they, the way they do it is very, I mean, it's not quite at the level of what you're talking about, no gift, no giver, but it's very spontaneous and simple, and of course they would do that. I think it's hard, I think our culture struggles with it.
More ordinary.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
Maybe more ordinary.
Customary. Yes, and we have, well, it's, well, it is in the Bible, but somehow it's not, we have a big overlay of all those thoughts you were talking about. Well, giving this to this person, and I know they're just going to go to a liquor store, and then, so there's all this, whereas in the East, they just throw money in the bowl or give food to the monks, and whether they throw the money in the bowl and the person does go up and get drunk, they just don't seem to worry about it. I don't know. That I'm speculating about.
Is that part of the notion that the generosity is the virtue that produces peace? Is it is whatever that feeling is without puffing it up or anything else, or just tossing
it in that present moment, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so they're not worrying about what happens next or whatever, they're just spreading peace that way.
I think there's definitely a shame to generosity in our society. And I think that's what maybe keeps us from saying something in that grocery store line, is other people looking and other people judging us and other people wondering if we're showing off and what will my spouse say, you know. I just had a thing tonight, right before I walked out the door, I told my husband about something I was going to do. Which is an act of generosity, and he kind of poo-pooed it, you know. He was just, and I said to him, "Oh, you're such a downer. I'm not, you know." I think what I said is, "Well, then maybe I don't need to share these things with you. This is my money." I thought I should share it because he's my husband, and we both agreed. No, I don't even need to share that with him because he can't participate in the warm fuzzy that I feel, you know, and I think that's part of that grocery store line thing, or the guy on the corner thing or whatever is other people not approving of what we're doing. And that's kind of sad, and maybe they don't have that shame part over, you know, in the Middle East where, you know, it's just, it's accepted.
Yeah, it's very supportive.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there is, they do take pride in it in some way. You know, I'm sure it's never, you know, this pure, totally pure, but I think the culture really supports that, the giving.
Well, thank you all for such a wonderful conversation. I can't do this alone.
Thank you, Walter.
Thank you.
I'm hoping that if you happen to go through a store and see this book, you'll at least say, oh yeah, I heard of that book. Walter talked about it and got all sorts of things. So, and I just want to say how much I enjoy being in Longmont.
Thank you.